The following program is an original production of Link TV.
Since 9/11, one Muslim voice has drowned out all the others in the West. Have Osama bin Laden and his followers hijacked Islam? And if they have, how can 1.2 billion Muslims around the world reclaim their faith? In the next hour, we'll explore how Muslims are confronting violence in the name of Allah in this Link TV original program, Who Speaks for Islam? Welcome. I'm your host, Ray Suarez. Today, somewhere across the vast slice of planet Earth where a majority of people are Muslim, farmers worked their fields, teachers taught their pupils, families sat down to dinner, their lives punctuated by the call to prayer echoing through the streets from Africa's Atlantic coast to the southern Philippines. And at the same time, men prepared to blow themselves up and kill others. Terrorist soldiers trained and technicians loaded websites and videotapes with a message of threat, blood, and murder. Today, in 2005, almost 1,400 years after the Prophet Muhammad fled from Mecca to Medina, who speaks for Islam? Who fires the hopes, the imagination, the spirits of more than a billion people living across all the world's continents, including North America? Does Osama bin Laden speak for Islam? If not, who does? In the next hour, we bring you some Muslim voices you may not have heard before in this debate. Joining us in our studios in San Francisco is Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. So, how does a white Christian boy from America become a leading voice in the Islamic world? Hamza Yusuf embraced Islam at the age of 17. He studied with leading scholars in the Middle East. But it was his unique media movement that increased his influence around the world. This telegenic speaker of English and Arabic hosts a top-rated Arab satellite series, Journeys with Hamza Yusuf, winning over the hearts and minds of Muslim viewers. Having met with President Bush and advised the Arab League, he's become a bridge between Islam and the West. And Hamza Yusuf, when we ask that question, who speaks for Islam, is there embedded in that question an assumption that there should be somebody who speaks for Islam?
Well, I think that within religious traditions, you have to have some normative voices that represent the religion. I think, for instance, most Christians would not feel that the Branch Davidians speak for Christians, but you can't deny that's a manifestation of the Christian religion. So I think we have, if people would just take Islam and replace it with Christianity or Judaism or any other world religion, I think they're going to recognize that, for instance, the majority of Christians certainly don't agree with blowing up abortion clinics, even though they might be opposed to abortion as a practice. But there are Christian fundamentalists who are willing to go out and kill a doctor or nurses or innocent people because they believe it's mass murder and it has to be stopped. So I think within, obviously, with Islam, because of the crises, and actually many crises in the Muslim world, the situation's complicated by the fact that there are increasing numbers of people that are being radicalized and marginalized. You have basically religious anarchy, which is unfortunately what we're suffering from.
Well, is it that anarchy, that crisis of authority that Osama bin Laden marches into?
He definitely has marched into that, and he's obviously struck a chord in a certain segment of the society, and some more than others. Unfortunately, I would say in some ways he's like a Spartacus character for oppressed people. They see somebody who's standing up, and I think that's where you'll get that kind of emotional rabble aspect that you'll see on the streets, or his picture being taunted. I don't think it's that they're in support of his means, so to speak, but rather the more symbolic aspect of what he seems to represent as a type of resistance to what a lot of people perceive as an attack.
Well, how do you know that they don't approve of his means? Well, Aren't desperate people willing to embrace people?
I spent a lot of time in the Muslim world, and I continue to go there. I mean, I was in Arabia twice in the last several months, and I talk to people. I talk to people in the street. I talk to cab drivers. I do my own sociological surveys because I'm interested. I want to, you know and understand. And I talk to people that talk to other people just to get a sense of what's going on. And I really do believe that, you know, most Muslims, like most human beings, are abhorred by violence and certainly indiscriminate violence. I mean, the Muslims are not some kind of evil group out there. And I think it's very simplistic to look at the world like that. They're people that have eyes and ears and dimensions and organs just like everybody else. And if you prick them, they feel the pain. You know, if you tickle them, they laugh. And if you wrong them, they want revenge.
Let's take a closer look at how Osama bin Laden delivers his message to the waiting eyes and ears of the Islamic world. Turn on the television from Cairo to Kabul, and this is what you'll see. Nighttime raids in Iraq with the Arabic subtitle, American Occupiers Terrorize Women and Children.
In recent weeks,
and near nightly shots of clashes between Israelis and Palestinians,
particularly those near Jerusalem. Last month, three Palestinians were killed by army fire in such protests.
At Abu Ghraib prison outside Baghdad, where nearly 4,000 Iraqis are held, hundreds demonstrated outside the heavily guarded walls demanding the release of their relatives.
I call on all people, Arab and other nations, to look at what is happening to us. Look how we are being humiliated.
This dramatic montage appeared on Al Alam TV from Iran.
The cries of the oppressed, and throughout history, they tell us that oppression will not last, and the oppressors will not stay.
If this is the backdrop in the Middle East, upon this stage enters Osama bin Laden, a man completely tuned in to the popular sentiments of his audience.
ولكن السؤال الذي يطرح نفسه وبقوة هو هل هذه الحكومات في العالم الإسلامي مهيئة لأن تقوم بهذا الواجب بالدفاع عن الملة والأمة وأن تتبرأ من ولائها لأمريكا.
Joining us from Washington, D.C. is former CIA senior analyst Michael Scheuer. For 17 years, Scheuer has tracked terrorists, Islamic militants, and especially Osama bin Laden. From 1996 to 1999, he was chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit. Under the pen name Anonymous, he wrote two bestsellers, Through Our Enemy's Eyes and Imperial Hubris. Then, after 22 years of service, Scheuer stepped out of the shadows and into the media spotlight, resigning from the CIA in order to warn Americans we're losing the war on terror. Michael Scheuer, welcome. What is Osama bin Laden? Is he a politician? Is he a warrior? Is he a preacher? A little of all?
A little of all, I think, sir. He's clearly someone who is cut from the traditional, the historic leadership role in the Muslim world. He is a very soft-spoken man, a man of eloquence. Bernard Lewis has called him almost a poetic speaker of Arabic. Not a flamboyant individual, an individual who defers to his elders and to religious scholars. He's a very, very significant figure in Islamic politics, certainly, and in world politics.
Just a few moments ago, you heard Sheikh Hamza Yusuf say that many people in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, the wider world, sympathize with his message, but not his methods. Do you agree with that?
I think at this point I would say I do agree with that, that the number of people who are willing to pick up guns and fight Americans, if you will, is much smaller than the number who actually support Osama bin Laden. Unfortunately, I think the trend is going against the United States, and I think as time goes on, we're going to see more and more Muslims willing to pick up weapons or assist those who have picked up weapons.
I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I think that we're doing all the things as a nation. This nation is doing all the things that will actually exacerbate the situation, add fuel to the fire. And the thing a lot of people here in America don't realize, and I know Michael's very aware of this, is that Arab television, and there are many, many satellite televisions in the Arab world, Arab television shows daily atrocities, babies, burnt, charred babies. Some of them are reruns, and this happens in what's going on in Israel and what's going on in Iraq. And people see it. I mean, it's a daily experience.
Well, Michael Scheuer, are there any other voices that are the anti-Osamas?
I really think there is not much space in the public square at the moment for anti-Bin Laden messages, in the sense that Bin Laden's genius has lied particularly in identifying U.S. foreign policy as an attack on Islam and an attack on Muslims. So it's very difficult for a moderate or a liberal Muslim to speak up in support of the United States or in opposition to Osama bin Laden if it seems as though by doing so you support American policy toward Israel, you support the continuation of police states in Saudi Arabia and Egypt. So at the moment it's very hard for anyone to really become a countervailing voice to Osama bin Laden in the Muslim world.
Well, Michael Scheuer lays out a very bleak choice, Sheikh Hamza, supporting American policy or supporting bin Laden. Is there a third way?
I've spent a lot of time, like I said, in the Muslim world, and I think that people will have passing opinions and things like that, but the reality of it is, I think most people in the Muslim world, they go to the mosque, they hear preachers, they hear khutbahs, they watch television. I'm really not convinced that, you know, his impact and his influence is as wide as that would indicate. I really don't believe that. I think for people, if Iraq continues the way it continues, I think that potential is there. But I personally believe that there is still a lot of potential to stop that from being, you know, a self-fulfilling prophecy. I also feel that anybody who is pro-American in the Arab world is automatically written off. I do believe that. If you're pro-American foreign policy, what I tried to do in the television program that I had in the Arab world was to present, you know, the human side of this country, that there are many people in this country that disagree with the foreign policy. They're very sympathetic with people that are suffering in different places. They were against the bombing, all of these type things, that people need to see a more nuanced view of the world. And I think a lot of this polarization of us versus them type of scenarios, we have to just reject them flat out, both here in the West and also in the Muslim world. I mean, I think it's very dangerous for us to say, you know, my country right or wrong, my religion right or wrong. I really believe that.
Well, Michael Scheuer, what should Americans understand, in your view, about that wider world that makes it possible for there to be fertile ground for terrorism to take root in, for the Osama bin Laden message to be so widely heard?
The struggle that bin Laden is leading against us, in which I think, with all respect for Sheikh Hamza, is proliferating, is based on what we do in the Islamic world and not who we are or what we believe in. When President Clinton and President Bush, after him, continue to say they hate our freedoms and they hate our liberties, they're exactly incorrect. And as long as that's the American position, A, we give our enemy a leg up because that's not what he's fighting about, but B, we as a country will never take the measure of our opponent and really understand the threat that he poses.
Michael Scheuer, stay with us. We're going to take a short break. In the next part of our show, you'll meet an American Muslim woman who says the acts of Osama bin Laden have hurt her in a very personal way. Joining us in the studio is journalist Suhaila Al-Jadda. Suhaila was born in a small town in Ohio to one of only two Muslim families in town. She says she grew up the typical American girl, attending Christian schools, celebrating Christmas. It wasn't until her college years at George Washington University that she discovered an Islamic community of faith. That was her turning point. Today, Suhaila says she fully embraces her faith, praying five times a day, and last year, making the spiritual journey to Mecca, where she prayed with millions of Muslims from around the world. Professionally, Al-Jadda is a writer and journalist, speaking out about the Middle East on television and in newspapers. She defines her work as educating fellow Americans about Islam. And Suhaila, what's changed about the explanation you have to make to your fellow Americans in the last couple of years?
Well, a major change is that we have to prove our Americanness to the greater public. I think that before 9/11, we didn't have to explain that we are Americans. We are just like the next person. We're just like the neighbor next door. But after 9/11, after Osama bin Laden, we've had to make that extra effort to be that friendly neighbor. We've had to make that extra effort to show that, yes, we're American and we're proud and we're Muslim at the same time.
Haven't people who are in their various communities being friendly neighbors and being in business and students and out there in the community also been sending money overseas to organizations that support terror? Haven't they also been in contact with people who have made it possible to build international networks? Is being a good neighbor enough?
In any sort of society, in any sort of community, you're going to have some bad apples in that community. And you can't label the entire community based on those bad apples. I mean, we look at what happened in Abu Ghraib, and we don't blame the entire military for what happened in Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, where torture took place. In the same light, I think we should look at Muslims in the same light and say, look, yes, there are some Muslims who take things in their own hands and who use violence, but we shouldn't blame the entire community. We shouldn't label the entire community as one way or another.
What has this meant for you personally? How have you come up right against this and confronted it in your own life?
Well, look, I go to work every day. I commute 3 hours almost every day to work. So I have to interact with the public all the time. I'm talking to people. I talk to conductors and bus drivers. And I always have to interact with people. Once I got on the bus, and a group of teenagers came on the bus, and they sat down, they saw me wearing my scarf, and they said, you know, do you have a bomb in your bag? Are you going to blow up the bus? You know, do you have a button that you're going to press and blow us to smithereens? So I was kind of shocked by that. I was like, whoa, you know, what can I say? I mean, do I look like Osama bin Laden? Do I look like a terrorist? You know, I didn't know what to do. I just sat there thinking, should I tell them that, you know, not all Muslims are terrorists? Should I give them an ethics lesson on, you know, don't judge a book by its cover? So I didn't know what to do. I sat there and I did what I knew I could do best, which was shut up. I was just quiet. And I said, you know, it's not my time right now, and I don't want to make things bigger. I don't want to cause problems. But I knew that the way I looked, I knew that my headscarf was a symbol of terrorism. And that really, it really saddened me that just because I dress one way, I am perceived as suspicious or violent or, you know, someone who would be willing to blow up a bus.
Well, how do you seize that back? If you feel that's wrong, and it's clear you do, how does someone like you, going to work every day, doing the things you got to do in life, yes, sort of seize back that identity and proclaim that you're something else?
Well, part of it is not seizing back. I mean, we have to live in reality. And I'll tell you a secret that you probably won't hear from anyone else, but Muslim women after 9/11, they actually took off their scarves because they were afraid of being identified as Muslim. And many women who wanted to stay true to their faith, they decided, okay, I'm not going to take off my scarf, but I'm going to wear it differently. I'm going to wear a baseball cap, for instance, or the way I'm wearing my scarf right now. Some women believe that it makes us look less Muslim. And it's sad to say this, but These are some of the actions that we're taking in order to be able to live in the West and not be perceived as a threat, and yet live our religion at the same time. So, and the same is true with men. I mean, many men, Muslim men, they wear beards, just like you and Sheikh Hamza, they wear beards. And many men, they took their beards off, they shaved their beards off, they said, look, I don't want to be identified as a Muslim, because then people will look at me, people will stare at me and say things at me, and I'll be picked out of a line at the airport, or I'll be stopped by a cop. So these are just little sort of techniques that we use to navigate the waters as we live in this country, proud of being American, but trying to practice our religion at the same time.
Well, even with that sort of move toward anonymity in the public way, it doesn't entirely work, does it? I mean, you've been contacted by law enforcement, haven't you?
Sure. I mean, it doesn't work. And we, many Muslims, including myself, have been contacted by the federal authorities asking us questions on national security. And as an American, I want to help in protecting my nation and protecting my country, and I'll do whatever I can to do that. I mean, I worked for 4 years in public service, and I feel that we have a need to protect our country. But at the same time, we are feeling a lot of pressure, not from, just from the general public, but from the law enforcement, from the federal authorities, who are sort of pigeonholing the Muslims in one group, and in some cases intimidating Muslims. In the way they ask their questions, going to the workplace to ask questions. So there's these pressures that are on us that we have to deal with. And at the same time, we have to also deal with our own community and the bad guys in our own community. So it makes it even harder for us.
Well, is there any way that contacting people like you is legitimate and legitimately part of an investigation? Or you think it's just out of bounds?
What use is it if you have thousands of names in a database and you decide, okay, they're all Muslim, we're just going to go and talk to them and ask them questions just because their name is Muhammad or because their name is Ahmed? Of course, if they have a lead on a case, yes, I would want them to go and contact people and to ask them questions. And I would want my fellow Muslims to answer the questions and give them the information needed to protect our country, because that's our duty to do that. But when it's done in a way, in a matter where intimidation is used, where people are feeling threatened and they're feeling targeted, I don't think that's right.
Or if their names are Hamza Yusuf?
Well, I mean, if your name was Abdullah Ahmed, for instance, you'd fit the profile. I mean, just the way you look. Like, you know, you look like an Arab to me. I mean, you could easily pass for an Arab in an Arab country. So if you go to an airport and somebody sees you, you know, I think for me, the real problem with the racial profiling is we have over 6 million Muslims in this country. And I think that's probably a conservative personally, just because when I first heard that, I had one child and now I have five. So we've got a lot of Muslims in this country. We have more Arab Christian Muslims in this country than we have Arab Muslim Muslims. A lot of Americans don't know that. So, you know, I mean, Danny Thomas's daughter,
Marlo
Thomas, you know, do we profile her or her husband, Phil
Donahue?
Because he's kind of pro-Palestinian, isn't he? I mean, maybe we should, you know, I think with the type of sophistication that these people have, it'd be a little easier to weed out. And another thing that's very obvious to me is people that are dissenting voices in this country about foreign policy, and there are many Muslims in this country that might have personal opinions that they never articulate. But yeah, they're troubled by foreign policy in the Middle East in particular. But those of us who do speak out and voice our views, believing that we have a constitutional right to do so, suddenly we're targeted as, you know, this person's anti-American. Well, wait a second, what does that mean, anti-American? This is my patria, and this is my homeland, and this is where I was born, this is where my ancestors came to. and I love this country and I want to see good for this country. That doesn't mean I have to agree with everything the federal government is doing.
Suhaila Al-Jadda, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And we're continuing with Who Speaks for Islam. In the Middle East, there are other powerful voices who speak for the faith. Recently, we journeyed to Egypt to interview the first influential sheikh to speak out against Osama bin Laden after the 9/11 attacks.
Nightfall in the old city of Cairo. During the season of Ramadan, the streets are full of the faithful, breaking their fast. It's a time of celebration and prayer. Never far from sight is the Mosque of Al-Azhar, a center of Islamic learning for more than 1,000 years. Students from more than 100 countries come to Al-Azhar for religious study. It's the oldest existing university in the world, and presiding over this institution is the Grand Imam, Muhammad Sayyid Tantawi, one of the highest spiritual authorities in Sunni Islam.
Al-Azhar al-Sharif له رسالة محددة. هذه الرسالة المحددة هي بيان أن الإسلام دين يمد يده بالسلام إلى كل من يمد يده إليه بالسلام.
After 9/11, Sheikh Tantawi condemned the acts of Al-Qaeda, ruling that Osama bin Laden's call for jihad was invalid and not binding on Muslims. Sheikh Tantawi was hailed in the U.S. Congress for clearly drawing a line between Islam and terrorism.
إرهاب والعنف ضد تعاليم الإسلام 100%.
Joining us here in the studio is Hatem Bazian, an expert on Islamic law from the University of California at Berkeley. Well, you just saw Sheikh Tantawi say that terrorism and violence are 100% against the teachings of Islam. Is he, well, first of all, do you think he's right?
Well, as far as Islamic law, he's definitely speaking from authority and speaking reflective of the Islamic tradition, legal tradition. But in here, you also have to confront the fatwa, the legal opinion that Osama bin Laden have issued, which calls for an open season on all Americans. Now, how do we evaluate Osama bin Laden's fatwa? In the sense that Osama bin Laden has no standing as a legal expert in Islam. Actually, his expertise is as a demolition and a construction expert, not one who is actually a specialist in Islamic law. I often tell my students in the classroom, it is akin if I, being their professor, issued a legal opinion on behalf of the Supreme Court and published it in the newspaper in the New York Times, say that Roe versus Wade is abolished and the law of the country will be as such that abortion will be illegal. Now everybody would laugh me out of the country, and hopefully that people will do that who have some expertise.
But in the absence of generally accepted authorities, does charisma take the place of authority, and does Osama bin Laden get to speak louder than Sheikh Tantawi?
Well, I think in here what we're dealing with, we have a political issue and a political crisis that we have to deal with, that the institution, state institutions, have failed the society. And as such, the loudest voice that is in opposition to the state gets the loudest or the majority of following as a protest of the institutions that we have. This is the political institution, the religious institution, the academic institutions in general. There is a failure. And as such, Osama bin Laden is essentially is a rebel that knows exactly how to cater and design his message to fit the political spectrum that we're dealing with. Our issue in the Middle East is a political issue, first and foremost.
There's also something that bin Laden has that's very powerful in the Muslim world, and that is that he was a multi-millionaire from a billionaire family and gave all of that up to go to Afghanistan. That was his original juice or momentum that he really brought with him. Because if he was a baker from Cairo who was very clever and was in Afghanistan, he would have nowhere near the type of impact. But the fact that everybody thinks, God, this guy was living in palaces, he had everything that you know, so many of, you know, the ambitious people dream about, and he gave it all up.
Joining us now from Chicago is Professor Amina McLeod, Chair of the Islamic World Studies Program at DePaul University. Professor, welcome. Who speaks for Islam?
Thank you. I think all of us do. I think all of us speak for Islam, and here in America, I would certainly hope that in the future, with programs like this, that it is more us speaking for Islam than an imported voice.
Why do you think it is that we hear less a cleric saying that, sorry, this just isn't Islam, killings, explosions,
well, there,
and so on,
no
versus
space.
Somebody who gets on and says that this blood is going to pay for a specific set of crimes by the West?
Well, I think something that was mentioned earlier, that there's no real space for those who really have something to say that perhaps might lead to a solution. But there is some space for us to continue with the whipping up of animosities and hostilities, because we need that to legitimate our own acts overseas.
Michael Scheuer, when you look across the communications, the messages that are being heard by the world's Muslims, are people who, for want of a better term, we might call moderates, stepping up and making sure they're heard in the chorus?
No, I think probably not. And I think, as I said earlier, part of it is the genius of bin Laden focusing on foreign policies that the great majority of Muslims view as anti-Islamic. For as educated as Sheikh Tantawi is, he has very little sway in the Muslim world because he is, for better or worse, viewed by many people as a mouthpiece for Hosni Mubarak's government. And that's the real problem.
The calls for jihad, how they're heard in the Islamic world, how they're understood, not just in the Islamic world, but in the wider world. Let's return to Sheikh Tantawi and have him speak more specifically to the issue of jihad.
فالجهاد في الإسلام لم يشرع إلا من أجل أمرين أساسيين. الأمر الأول الدفاع عن النفس وعن المال وعن الأرض وعن المسكن وعن كل ما أمرنا القرآن بالدفاع عنه. والأمر الثاني نصرة المظلوم. لأجل هذين الأمرين شرع الجهاد في الإسلام.
Citing that right to self-defense, Osama bin Laden has called upon all Muslims to launch a jihad on Americans, including civilians who pay taxes and support the military.
وبين يدي الحديث أقول لكم إن الأمن ركن مهم من أركان الحياة البشرية وإن الأحرار لا يفرطون بأمنهم بخلاف ادعاء بوش بأننا نكره الحرية فليعلمنا لما لم نضرب السويد مثلا وإنما قاتلناكم لأننا أحرار لا ننام على الضيم نريد إرجاع الحرية لأمتنا فكما تهدرون أمننا نهدر عنكم.
Professor McLeod, Osama bin Laden closed by saying, just as you threaten our security, we shall threaten yours. Strictly as an outsider and as an observer, it seems like the calls for political struggle and killing in the form of terrorism from one part of this debate is much less equivocal, much more clear, and much more strident than the voices on the other side, who often speak in flowery but ambiguous language about their belief that that's an illegitimate way to proceed. Is that a problem?
I think it is a problem, but I think perhaps it's a problem for different reasons. People feel that they've been put in a corner. You can't speak against legitimate resistance. People do not want to be occupied and have no say in their government, even though perhaps the previous government didn't give them a say either, on one hand. On the other hand, voices inside the United States have been speaking stridently against terrorism in all of its form, from us or from them, and have offered solutions, but the cameras have not turned on them.
Michael Scheuer, same question. Has the debate over who speaks for Islam, both inside and outside the Muslim world, been fed by the idea that one side is being much more aggressive in its rhetoric and another side isn't?
I don't know if I'd use the word aggressive, but I think authentic. I think bin Laden speaks in a historical tone. Muslims are extraordinarily conscious of their history, and allusions to Islamic history that bin Laden uses are everyday allusions in the Islamic world. And he is an extraordinary man in many ways, and to kind of underestimate him is a mistake. I think bin Laden speaks very authentically. I don't think he's a terrorist. I think he's a resistance leader, and I think we haven't understood that yet. And the Muslim world, to be frank, is bereft of leadership. There's very few people that have I love the Al Saud family on their bumper stickers. It's just it just doesn't happen. And so bin Laden not only is an authentic voice, he is a lone voice in terms of being a credible leader and in terms of being a heroic figure.
How do you respond to what you just heard from Michael Scheuer?
Once again, I go back to when we look at the nation state structure in the Arab and Muslim world, and in particular in the Arab world, we have to account for a failure of the nation state structure. Really, we have failed states, even though that they are operational on one level, internally they are failing. You have to also add to it that 60%, 50 to 60% of the young population, age 18 to 24, essentially is sitting unemployed without any possibility of future, without the possibility of a job. And therefore, we have to begin to deal with these issues. Osama bin Laden is saying that the problem in here is a result of the cooperation between this corrupt leadership that has been allied to the United States and the United States foreign policy that is in the region for one reason and one reason only, and that is for the oil. That's a powerful message. On the other end, you have what we consider to be the scholars of Islam, who are not at least as skilled in delivering the message. And here we have to speak of the medium. Television is an important medium. And I think Osama bin Laden is skilled at using that medium and conveying his message, while I would say Tantawi and others have no sense of what the importance of this medium to get this message out. So our issue is really political, economic, and social conditions that we have to look in the Arab and Muslim world before we begin to actually speak whether Islam is the problem that we need to actually confront.
When you had Sheikh Tantawi on, the conditions he laid down for jihad, either to repel an invader or to protect oppressed Muslims, there's no space between what he defines as jihad and what Osama bin Laden defines as jihad. Right. And I also have to say that,
I think there is just a little bit of space in that Tantawi does not presume that either the defense of Muslims or the coming to the aid of oppressed Muslims including people who are not involved in the conflict at all.
Well, I think that's not correct. I think Sheikh Tantawi speaks very articulately about historical jihad, and when he does, there is, I think, a much clearer view in the Islamic world that innocents get killed in wars, that there has been in the West. I would also point out that Sheikh Tantawi.
I think the issue in here whether you intentionally could target civilians in the conduct of war.
That's agreed upon.
And that's
everybody's against
it's
that.
It's a consensus on that.
But I think, to be fair to Michael, well, there is, in normative Islam, if you look at the madhhabs that have been practiced in the Muslim world historically, there is a consensus amongst the scholars. There are opinions out there that are dredged up by bin Laden's ilk that negate that. You will find that in Christian canon law. You'll find that in Judaism as well. I mean, that's a problem in religious legal textual tradition.
But Sheikh Hamza,
you get crazy opinions. But to be fair to you, there is, and I know there is a preemptive jihad theory in Islamic legal tradition, but that has not been practiced at all since the Ottoman Empire.
And Sheikh Hamza, just taking the example of Iraq, Sheikh Tantawi, many of the sheikhs in Saudi Arabia identified as enemies of Islam any Muslim who supported the occupation forces in Iraq.
Unfortunately, I think there's been some fatwas issued by individuals that were unwise.
Well, whether they were unwise or not, I think there is room to conclude they were unwise. But when gentlemen like Sheikh Tantawi identify Muslims who support the American occupation of Iraq as infidels,
I mean, who are you? Aish, you have a government that is put in by outside forces, and I think that people resist an occupation cannot be held against them in that way.
I think the resistance is a genuine resistance. What I'm saying is, when we talk about innocents being killed, so many of the people in Iraq that have been killed by the resistance are Muslims who are supporting the invader.
But that puts them in a different category if they're supporting the invader.
Some Muslim scholars are speaking about cooperation with the occupation being something that is contrary to Islamic law. And I think you could find some people that these arguments would have some standing within the law. But this is actually a result of Americans' own making in relation to the Iraq occupation and not to Baudelaire.
Here's an example of a very different kind of preaching. Recently, there was a Muslim conference on extremism. And I was very struck by the words of one Shiite imam from Michigan. Here's what he had to say.
We must know that extremism is cancerous and it is dangerous. It is dangerous for Muslims. It is dangerous for non-Muslims. It is dangerous for the image of Islam. I ask you, my dear brothers and sisters, when those extremists go wild and commit atrocities in the name of Islam, who pays the price? Of course, it is Islam. Islam that has been hijacked by those people. It is Islam that always pays the price. And I tell you, my dear brothers and sisters, that the worst enemy of Islam is the one that rests within.
Professor McLeod, an enemy within, the worst enemy of Islam?
Well, I think he's talking about the extremists, the people who, like Dr. Barzian was speaking of, who don't see a future, have seen corrupt governments supported by us, who exist and do exist among us and in the masajid across the United States. And he's in the United States asking the rest of us to pay attention. We've heard it. Some of us have heard it, moved to speak out against it, and we ourselves were not heard.
Sheikh Hamza, so what is that call for? What's the bottom line for both American Muslims and Muslims in some of these countries where, as Professor Bazian suggests, politics hasn't worked?
Well, I think that the American Muslims have a similar situation to the Jewish Americans, and that is that we identify with people outside of the United States as in a strong way. So, And the Jews traditionally in this country were often looked at. Same with the Catholics, in fact. I mean, Kennedy, that issue came up. So I think that both the Catholics and the Jews, or at least most of those people, have proven that somebody can be an American and yet have strong attachments to issues outside of this country. And so there are many Arab Americans, Pakistani Americans, Indian Americans that are concerned about American foreign policy vis-a-vis those countries in particular. Now, what we have to do in this country is recognize that, you know, we have a war right now with a Muslim country, and there's an immense amount of animosity. I feel that we have a very, very important role in attempting to turn down the flame.
But today, there are millions of Americans who will tune into the news one day this week as the level of violence is increasing. They will see both civilians and American forces blown up, torn apart, jeeps and other vehicles on fire, and a message delivered from the perpetrators of those acts saying they did it in the name of Islam. Maybe during that same broadcast, hear an American Muslim say, well, that has nothing to do with my religion. that has nothing to do with what I believe. What's the more compelling point that's being made? What's an American going to take away from that delivery of those two very powerful messages?
Historically, religion has always been co-opted in nationalist resistance. I mean, Ireland's a good example of that, the Protestant Catholic. I don't think very many Catholics would see that issue as a Protestant Catholic issue. But religion is, Muslims believe, you know, if you die defending your land, you go to heaven. That is a belief. So that is obviously a way of motivating people to defend their homeland. But I think Americans, most Americans that I know in this country, I mean, my father signed up as soon as he could after Pearl Harbor. He was, you know, he was a Civil War, World War II veteran. So I think Americans want to defend their land as well. That's such a natural thing. And there are many that will go with their cross and with their Bible and believe that it's a just war, it's a just cause. So, I think just to say, oh, it's in the name of Islam. No, they're Muslims, and many of them believe that what they're doing is right.
Well, Professor McLeod,
also,
go ahead.
The people watching that television program are, of course, going to take the first message. And it makes the people coming behind them who are saying, no, Islam means peace, and no, that's not my religion, they're either lying or they're covering up something. And so I think that there is a wager being placed in front of us, is how are we going to educate Americans about Islam in its entirety, the good parts and the bad parts, and give them an opportunity to place what is happening now in a place.
Well, let me show you an excerpt from a news program, which, I don't know, depending on what your point of view is, may contribute to the problem or provide information to solve it. Let's take a look.
Well, since 9/11, we've seen a number of terrorist videos like the one released today. They use them as a recruitment tool, also to bolster their image, also to affect a new generation. A sign of that is in today's video. Look at this. The image of a young child carrying a weapon as a father is heard telling his son to strive to be a martyr. It's a disturbing reminder that across the Middle East, at some homes and schools, children are being taught to hate the West. It's the kind of education the U.S. is fighting, or trying to, in the war of ideas. Qadr Atullah Afiz is like millions of Pakistani children enrolled in strict Islamic schools. He's being taught to hate America. The United States is bombing innocent Muslims, he says. America says Osama bin Laden is a terrorist. They blame the Taliban, but they are the biggest terrorist of all. Qadr Atullah learned all this at his madrasa, a conservative religious school for kids too poor to attend government schools. There are tens of thousands of madrasas in Pakistan offering free books, free meals, and free education, a daily dose of radical Islam and jihad.
Well, what do you think, Professor?
These Quranic schools are often the only avenue where literacy is actually given to students and kids, where if you don't belong to the elite, which is part of the political structure that is there, that goes to the advanced educational institutions, schools, and then they make it to universities, and off they are into the West to some of the best education. This is basically about 80% of the population in some parts of the Muslim world that is the only access for literacy. Now, here a side issue in terms of these schools, we put them actually to use during the Afghan-Soviet war, where some of the books that we put in there, we wanted to create a particular worldview, and as such, we contributed to a radicalization of some schools in the border area between Afghanistan and Pakistan for our own
Well, there's the eventual leaders and foot soldiers of the Taliban came out of those
that
schools.
We had footage of CIA advisors encouraging jihad. I've seen it on our own news broadcast. We had footage of CIA advisors there saying, go out and fight a jihad against Russia. You know, and that's part of the problem. Blowback is a major problem here. You know, we won't take responsibility as a nation for the fact that much of what we're witnessing today is our own creation.
Well, it's always interesting to me that somehow the CIA is blamed for what was caused by the invasion of Afghanistan by the Soviet Union. Let me tell you from the perspective of someone who worked on this issue for 10 years that There is never a more altruistic covert action program than our support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And not because we wanted it that way, but simply because the Afghans and their allies would not listen to what we wanted to do. I wish we could take credit for creating such an intricate and dangerous tool, but unfortunately, it's just an argument that doesn't hold water. What we had in Afghanistan with the Taliban is exactly the religion of Saudi Arabia. It's been said that the Taliban in Afghanistan looks like what Saudi Arabia would look like without the Al Saud family. And I think that's probably exactly correct. This is a huge issue in the Muslim world. And it denigrates, I think, the religious beliefs of many Muslims to think somehow the West is the one that created this movement. We just discussed the authenticity.
No, I don't think the West created the movement either. We're not saying that.
What you want to do is absolve the West of any participation in the creating of a monster. And I think as long as we refuse to have any culpability, we're always right, we do no wrong, then what is happening will continue to happen and it will escalate.
It's clearly not my brief to say everything we do is wrong. I think is correct. What we've done in Iraq is slowly change Al Qaeda and Bin Laden into Al Qaedaism and Bin Ladenism around the world. But my point is that, as we discussed earlier, there is an authenticity in Bin Laden's voice that appeals to many Muslims across the ideological spectrum. And for better or worse, martial activity has always been part of Islam. The Prophet was a soldier as well as a prophet. And there is no really tradition in Islam to turn the other cheek.
That's not true. There is a tradition.
Let me, at this point, get us to talk about where to go from here. We've talked, in the words of Professor Bazian, about failed states. In the words of Professor McLeod, about a monster. We've heard Michael Scheuer talk about Bin Ladenism and Al-Qaedaism spreading across the Muslim world. Given the way the table is set today in 2005, where do you go from here to turn around some of these terrible cycles that are, in the view of many of you who have spoken during this program, only worsening? Professor Bazian?
I want to have a real sincere dialogue, not the dialogue of a slave and master. I tell you when to jump, how high to jump, or where to jump, but rather sincere dialogue. A dialogue that we have a vested interest in this world. We have a vested interest between the haves and the have-nots. We have a vested interest in sharing the world resources. And as such, this dialogue should be founded upon sincerity, should be vested in attempting to rescue much of, I would say, the world is in complete disarray, not only the Muslim world, but much of the Muslim world and the world in general. For the United States, I would say, for us in here, we have a bad product to sell to the world right now. The U.S. foreign policy is not only opposed in the Muslim world, but rather in much of the world.
Sheikh Hamza, where do we go from here?
In terms of education, we as Muslims have an immense project here, and that is, how do we restore an Irenic Islam, an Islam that is rooted in the idea of love of God and love of fellow man. And I totally disagree with Michael. I think there is a very strong tradition in the Islamic belief and faith, and I adhere to it, that forgiveness is something that needs to be spread out. But you have to have people of goodwill on both sides, the people that have wronged people and the people that have been wronged. And there needs to be an immense amount of work for conciliation. The media has an incredible role. But I have to be optimistic. It's an obligation in my religion to be optimistic. And I have 5 children, and I want to see the world a less frightening place for them. And that's what I'm committed to.
Michael Scheuer, your prescription?
I'm frankly not interested in empathizing or sympathizing with the enemy. I'm very interested in understanding him so we can more adequately defend America. And I think, unfortunately, we don't understand him, and we're losing this war at the moment.
And Professor McLeod, you get the last word.
Oh, I love it. I don't think that the vacuum that's already been created in the Muslim world with respect to leadership is going to help any of us. I think that leadership is now perhaps going to have to come from Muslims in the West. I agree with Mr. Shore that we all need to know what's going on better, and we need to know more about the people that are perpetuating it. And that in the end, I'm being optimistic because, like Hamza, I have bunches of kids, but I also have grandkids. And I really do not want to see us, as I read in the paper yesterday, now add on more countries to our quest for terrorism.
Amina McLeod, thank you. Thank you, Michael Shoyer, and Hatem Bazian, and Sheikh Hamza Yusuf. Thank you all.
Thank you.
With America, for better or worse, deeply involved in the Muslim world and its future, and with millions of Muslims now living in the United States, both native-born and from across the world, this country has to have a better grasp of what Muslims believe and what Islam teaches. And Muslims, both in America and abroad, have much to tell the rest of us as we all head down that long road that may lead to a more peaceful future. I hope for our guests and for our viewers, this program was one step down that road. We can't fix it until we understand it. Thanks for watching. For Link TV, I'm Ray Suarez. We leave you now with some more Voices of Islam.
There was a survey, 47% or something of Americans don't even know what we believe still. They have no idea. A friend of mine, his wife, gave birth in the Santa Clara area. And after 10 hours of labor or 12 hours of labor, the nurse came to him and said to him, "Can I ask you a question?" She's been with him for 10 hours, right? For this difficult situation. They've been in the trenches together. The nurse says to him, "Why do you want to kill Christians?" After 10 hours of being him with him, or after being with him for 10 hours or 12 hours, she still has no idea who we are. So it is part of our own inactivity which has created this misunderstanding. So what we have to do is to be active in the society.
Forgiveness is the most important thing between people and societies. So I pray for there to be forgiveness between Muslims and all other groups.
To learn more about this program, visit www.linktv.org. Funding for this program was provided by the Rockefeller Brothers Fund.